Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Brad Hunter. Brad spearheads Home Advisors and analysis and tracking of housing markets and the home improvement industry using proprietary data from Home Advisor. In his former position, Mr. Hunter was chief economist and director of consulting for Metro Study, where he orchestrated hundreds of area-specific housing market studies over his 18 years at the firm. He also presented original research and insights to the federal agencies that focused on housing industry during the depths of the housing crisis. Brad, we welcome you to our show.
Bruce, it's a pleasure to be on.
Home Advisors, tell me why I would go visit the site and what services does it provide?
Home Advisor is an online matching service that helps to put people who own homes and need somebody to help them to do a renovation or repair project together with the pros that do that work. And we're most well known because of our vetting process. We actually reject anywhere between 10 and 15% of the pros that apply to be part of our network because we're so strict on who we let in.
Is there some type of feedback process that somebody's used one of the contractors and they're able to feedback and say, yeah, this is that worked out well or didn't?
Correct. Yes. So the individual consumers that utilize our service give ratings based on their experience, and then we combine that with the screening process that we do up front, and that kind of is a 1-2 punch to make sure that you get somebody good.
Nationwide?
Nationwide.
Okay. Yeah. And the cost of accessing that?
Well, it doesn't cost anything for the consumer to access it.
Okay. Do you find that people that are, we're in the business of rehabbing houses, and our clientele does that, so do you find that rehabbers use this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There are a lot of people who are, of course, buying homes, fixing them up, and putting them back on the market. And so I find that there are actually two points in time where a big surge in home improvement happens relative to an individual house, and that's right before it's sold and then right after it's sold. So what happens, of course, is that people that are getting the house ready for sale, whether they're flippers or whatever their situation might be, or just individual normal homeowners, they need to get the house prepared for resale and get ready to pass inspections. And if they don't pass an inspection, they have to get a repair done for that as well, but also just to make the place look beautiful and maximize the curb appeal and maximize the value. And then after the sale occurs, of course, the person that buys it wants to personalize it and make it their own space, and so they put money into it as well.
You're an economist, so the economy has something to do with somebody's willingness to expend money, maybe let's call it discretionary projects.
Yes, big
so,
time.
Yeah, what phase are we in right now? For what mood are we in?
Well, yeah, the economy definitely drives what goes on in home improvement. Confidence and equity are a couple of the key components. Confidence in my ability to say I know what my income is going to be next year, more or less, and that it's going to be hopefully increasing. And then home equity is back. We've seen about an 80% increase in home values since the bottom. And the Fed indicates that the average homeowner now has $167,000 worth of equity. So most of the people who were underwater in their mortgages are now well above. And that is driving an increase in what we consider major home improvement projects. So kitchen projects, kitchen remodels are up 50%. Bathroom remodels are up about 50%. Garage remodels are up 60%. So people trying to make better use of that kind of external or kind of adjacent space. Multiple room major renovations are up nearly 70% in the last year, and according to the number of service requests coming through our network.
Just feeding off of what you just said, so there's $167,000 of equity that showed up in the lives of somebody that owned a house, and the person that renting next door didn't enjoy that. So is there a
Correct.
Big financial outcome difference for people that ultimately don't own?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it is harder for people that don't own, that are trying to get into home ownership. Of course, it's a great time if they can put together the down payment because mortgage rates are very low, so it's actually a fantastic time to buy. Rents are extremely high, so again, it's a fantastic time to buy relative to renting. But a lot of people are having trouble coming up with that down payment, and I often joke that they rely on a new form of GI financing, which now stands for generous in-laws.
I think you're right, man. I really do. What's interesting about the interest rates right now, I do a lot of speaking in front of an audience, and I don't think there's much appreciation of how unbelievable these rates are.
So low that anybody who is considering refinancing or buying a house should take into account that this is the golden opportunity, and rates are certainly going to go up to some degree a year from now or 2 years from now. And that, even if the rates are still at, 4.5% or 5%, which is still a very, very low rate by historical standards, the monthly payment could be up 15% compared to what it is today, maybe more.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about this financing is almost everybody's getting something that's fixed. So there's no balloon danger. That's the one disadvantage of being a renter is that no one's going to fix your rent.
Yeah, that's right. And, talking about home improvement, when I think about the fact that mortgage rates are going to increase at some point in the future, and as we talked about, the monthly payment's going to increase, that may cause people 2 or 3 years from now to actually put more money into home improvement and maybe adding space to an existing home or something like that, because they'll be faced with the decision of, do I want to walk away from my nice 3.5% 30-year fixed and, get a mortgage that maybe is 4.5 or whatever the number is at that point in time. And so they may say, I'd rather just stick with the house that I've got, keep this fantastic mortgage rate, and put money into the house and make it more livable, update it, add space, reorganize the garage, whatever it is.
Well, you coined the term, the concept of churn. So
yeah,
we're going to be missing some churn then.
Well, we would be missing some churn, so that is a kind of counter part to that equation. However, I think that on balance, you would still get an increase in activity, that home improvement activity. And you mentioned churn. I've talked about it in terms of recent numbers in existing home sales, and relating it to the fact that in our numbers, the number of service requests that we've seen go through our system in the last year related to moving is up 90%. The number associated with inspections is up 40%. So, again, relating to people moving to a different home.
How do demographics affect home improvement?
Well, I guess, like I said, the number one demographic is wealth, and the number one driver of personal wealth is equity. And then when you look at different age groups, that's another way to slice demographics. Currently the baby boomers are doing the majority in terms of dollar spend of home improvement. But we are really expecting to see the millennial generation step up in the next few years and do a lot more home improvement. First of all, they don't have a very high home ownership rate.
Well, they have to become a household first.
Well, that's right. Yeah, then they've certainly delayed that. But what I'm seeing in the data is that they are just doing it later. They are getting married. They are having children. And we think that that's going to increase in the future for that Generation Y. And that's a massive generation. It's actually a bigger generation than the baby boom generation. So it's going to drive a lot of economic activity, a lot of home buying, and a lot of renovation.
What's interesting about an output gap, there's times that you can't make up the gap, but this is one that probably will be made up. So we have a household creation gap that ultimately will be fulfilled and probably play catch up. And that's going to be really big numbers.
It's already started to play catch up, and there's still plenty of runway left. Just think about it this way. Back a few years ago when the economy was softer than it is today, we were only creating 400,000 to 500,000 households in the country per year. And now we're just over a million a year. And I think we're going to probably kind of stabilize around 1.2, maybe 1.3 million a year. And that justifies, you know, a lot more new home construction, a lot more moving around.
How do you feel about the investor participation in this last cycle? For the first time in my memory, a single family home was really considered a cash flow vehicle. And so you had hedge funds decide that they would buy 10,000 homes. So what do you feel, how big of a market maker were they as buyers, and do you think they would have a chance to be a market maker if they decide to exit?
Sure. Well, okay, so you're talking about the Blackstones and groups like that. I mean, they had an impact on individual markets, individual neighborhoods. If you look at their impact just sort of numerically in the aggregate compared to what's going on in the entire country, they probably didn't have a significant impact on what happened with prices. I think they were the tail, not the dog. And I think that that's going to be true now that they're unwinding their holdings and selling off. I don't think that, you know, they're going to sell off and cause prices to go down into the tank, which I think some people are concerned about. I just don't see that as a big risk.
What about in the foreign investor participation? Have they in some ways been market makers, or is that also isolated to very small markets?
Yeah, it has been isolated. Certainly in Miami, you've had a huge influence from South American buyers buying the expensive luxury high-rise condos that have been developed in this last incredible wave that's happened. And then you go to California, Orange County, the Chinese buyers were driving a lot of the Irvine area kind of housing market, and they've pulled back quite a bit. In those kinds of micro markets, yes, they are market makers, and their changes in behaviors definitely have a major impact on what goes on. But in the aggregate nationwide, not as much.
Affordability, that seems to be, is interesting. We have interest rates that start with the 3, and we're all concerned about affordability. So how do you view affordability? Are you concerned about the levels that they're at?
Yeah, I mean, home prices have rocketed up at such an incredible rate. And in markets like San Francisco, affordability has become a major problem. I mean, you know, if you want to buy a detached home in San Francisco, it's well over $1 million to start. And a lot of other markets have become extremely costly as well. Even a market like Denver, which really didn't have sort of that boom-bust cycle, has become very pricey. I think that it is becoming an issue such that we'll probably see a slower rate of home price increase going forward. I was part of a survey of 100 economists that were surveyed by Zillow, and they asked me for my forecast of home price appreciation. And I think that home prices are going to generally go up at kind of a 3, you know, going down to 2% kind of rate over the next few years.
Do you feel that as affordability declines, well, I'll just ask you, what happens to other statistics? So affordability declines, what happens to sales volume?
Well, economics tells us that when the price gets high enough that the sales slow down. And I think that then we have to square that with what happens with all these households that we know are being formed. And the reality is it probably will keep the rate of household formation lower than what it ordinarily would be. Let's put it this way, if the Generation Y folks were behaving the same way that the baby boomers did at the same age, we'd be forming around 1.7 million households per year right now, and we're just barely over 1 million. So I think, again, my forecast is we're going to end up at 1.2, 1.3 million at an average rate, and that's going to be a lot lower than where it ordinarily would be. And then it is because of affordability, and it's because of just preferential shifts where people are saying, the luster is gone from home improvement for a lot of potential buyers. And so there's just a shift that's favoring a rental type of lifestyle for a lot of people.
We've had, in my life, we've had a few run-ups in prices. We've had, let's say, 75 to 80 in California. You're more knowledgeable about the national picture, but in California, that was a price run. 86 to 89, 2000 to 2006 or 6.5. So as prices go up, that's one of the main drivers of affordability direction. So as those prices went up a lot, affordability went down. What was interesting is our sales volume didn't go down with affordability decline. They went up. Construction went up.
Yeah, and that was kind of artificial demand to a degree, during the bubble, which is that period you just described from the early 2000s to 2006, that was momentum buying. People were buying, in a lot of cases, just because prices were going up so fast, and they wanted to get in and get out and make a lot of money, which a lot of people did until the music stopped, and a lot of people got their heads handed to them financially.
Yeah. But the same thing happened in 85 to 89 with volume. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm sort of just asking what your thought is. When part of the equation that happens is human nature kicks in and says, wow, I'm really good at this. I buy something that goes up, so I'm going to buy a bigger one, or I'm going to buy two. And lenders usually get rewarded by getting paid on time as prices go up because everyone has equity, so you can't really go into foreclosure because you have so much equity you can exit. And that's what's interesting this time to me is we have this pretty lofty affordability number. If you go across the board of, let's say, California's affordability, we're at 32-34%. That's a high number for us, not a low one. And yet volume of sales really is pretty stagnant. So to me, this is sort of an anomaly. We have really good affordability that's come off of 55, yes, down to 35 or 34. But our volume is not reacting like, okay, this is on sale or we're interested. So how do you feel the lending world is contributing to the lack of volume?
Well, yeah, let me just say something about that 85 to 89 period, too. That was coming out of a very deep recession in 81, 82, 83, and so things just were catching fire in terms of just overall growth, and that kind of led up to the dot-com bubble, and a lot of things were pumping, and people were looking for, as you said, more increases in their asset values, and I think housing was part of that, too. On the financing side, we're starting to get a little bit more clarity about the credit box. We're starting to see, banks loosening up a little bit. I think that what happened is the pendulum swung too far towards kind of ease in the boom period and in the bubble period, and then the pendulum swung too far towards tightness afterward. And I think we're still in the midst of that, but it seems to be easing up a little bit. As you said, we have these other affordability issues, not financing related, that are kind of impinging on people's purchasing. But, I do think that still a lot of people who should be getting mortgages are not able to, or they're just giving up on the process because it's just too difficult. And the lending world, I think, is still trying to catch up with the gig economy, and an Uber driver maybe has more difficulty showing his income and so on than somebody with a more traditional job. And so I think all those kinds of things are going on as well.
One thing that fascinates me is when I look at, let's say, a median income of an area and then the resulting median price, sometimes there's a very big disconnect. I'll use Miami and Tampa. Miami has a median income of $32,000 and a per square foot price of $364. Tampa has a median income of $45,000 and a median, a per square foot price of $106.
Yeah.
So when you have that kind of disparity in an area like Miami, is that telling you that the buyer isn't living there?
It does, to a degree. Well, there's two things. There's the buyer that doesn't live there, and within that, there is the international buyer. And if it's flight capital coming out of a wealthy family in Colombia or something like that, that's a whole different driver of the market. And then you also have in Florida, especially in Miami, a large number of people who are buying a house that they're only going to live in part of the year. And so, those people are mostly rich and have the ability to own and do own not just two homes, but three, four, five homes, maybe more. And those homes might be in Milan and Paris and, Miami and maybe one in Los Angeles to boot.
What about when you have, let's just use a standard income, median income in California, $60,000, something like that. Okay, there's an area like Austin, maybe it's $60,000, Orlando, it's 50 to 60. The disparity of income is not huge in percentage, and yet you have a very big difference in a median price that ends up in those states. Mm-hmm. So what's the reasoning for that? I really don't know. I'm fascinated to find out.
Well, a lot of it, it always comes down to supply and demand, and the supply is very constrained in places where there are physical land constraints or where there's just very little land left. Let's take, coastal Los Angeles. So if you look at Los Angeles County, Orange County, Ventura County, it's extremely expensive, and partly because there's just very little land left. And that's why the western portion of Riverside County has exploded. And now there are lot shortages along the north-south corridor there. And meanwhile, in those Texas markets, a great example of that would be Houston, where you can just grow farther and farther away from the urban core and then form newer urban cores. The Woodlands is a huge, huge master plan community that's almost an hour drive outside of Houston, and it's become its own new town, and it's got its own job nodes now. Major employers are there now, so people don't all of a sudden don't have to commute. They can live in the Woodlands and work in the Woodlands. So there's so many dynamics, but a lot of it does relate to land supply.
That's, just briefly, we did some investing in Texas, and somebody from McKinney said, well, we're next to Dallas. Well, no, you're not. I mean, if I say I'm next to Costa Mesa and I'm in Newport Beach, I am. I'm on a street that one side is this and the other side is that. You're driving 25 miles of cow pastures before you get to somewhere else in Texas. So an availability of land is crazy. We've got a minute left. What do you see coming forward, say, for the rest of 2016 and 2017 for real estate?
I think that we're going to see a slower pace of home price appreciation. I think we're going to see more home production. I think we'll also see a noticeable increase in these major home improvement projects, renovation projects, partly because of the home price escalation. We'll see more of the expenditures to try to make the current house that they're in more livable and up to date, use the space better, and those things are all going to be kind of driven by those factors that relate to supply and demand and price.
Okay. Well, Brad, I've really enjoyed our discussion today. This has been Brad Hunter with Home Advisors, and you can go to their website, and there's a lot of great information for us. Brad, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Bruce.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.